is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
The European Union, a product of the crisis of the 20th century, the First War, the Second War, the Cold War. The European Union entering the 21st century had large questions I learned from Stanley Pignal, who is the Charlemagne columnist for The Economist magazine. He helps me to understand, as a way as I had not before, that Europe understands itself as an enterprise that may not be the complete federal system that the U.S. enjoys with its states, but is certainly stronger than the parts were in previous centuries, certainly in the previous 20th century. Stanley names five crises that Europe has survived, the fifth being evidence that it has now matured to dealing with a crisis overwhelming another war in a fashion not predictable on the earlier moments. Stanley, a very good evening to you. If I understand it correctly, the four crises before the Ukraine one were a test that there was doubt whether the European Union was going to work. I want your help to remind my audience of these four crises. What was the Eurozone crisis? What created it? How was it solved?
So the Eurozone crisis was an extension of an imported crisis, which was the global financial crisis that started in the U.S. And that in the early stages impacted the European economy as any global recession would. But then over time morphed into something specifically European, which was a sovereign debt crisis. Some countries were very indebted and there had been it exposed. The recession exposed a weakness in the architecture of the euro, which at the time was only about a decade old, and that is that some bits of it are in common, some bits of the euro's architecture are in common, and some bits leave countries very isolated if they are over-leveraged. And a lot of people assumed that it could be resolved quickly, but it resulted in these terrible fights that deepened the recession in Europe for many years. And it was the first evidence that actually a crisis in Europe was both a dangerous thing, but also an opportunity because there's a belief in Europe that whenever there's a crisis, it might move the lines enough so that relationship you were describing between member states that are still independent, but forging an ever closer union, become a tighter union. So in the case of the Eurozone crisis, we had bailouts of countries, which from notably rich countries in Northern Europe, like Germany and the Netherlands, towards, for example, Greece. But we also had much tighter financial union afterwards. So all these things are part of the evolution of Europe.
If I remember my lessons from 08-09, we all had a bad time of it. But it was Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain.
Correct.
That were the question mark. And there was talk about splitting the euro into two parts, I believe, the northern euro and the southern euro. How was that solved? Was that Mario Draghi when he said whatever it takes? Was that the solution?
Exactly. So there had been questions whether the euro was viable. The old strategy that those countries had in southern Europe, including France, was to devalue the currency over time. So that's the way that you retained competitiveness in your economy, was to devalue the currency over and over again. And that was no longer possible when you had the euro, because obviously we shared a currency. And therefore, it became very difficult for those countries to keep on accessing capital markets. And really, the solution you would have in a normal union is you would have what are called fiscal transfers. You would have, Germany giving money to Italy in the same way that New York might give money to a poorer state in the union, or that a richer region in Germany gives money to a poorer region in Germany. But that the euro just wasn't built that way, definitely at the time. And therefore, that's what I was alluding to, is the sense of crisis kind of moving the lines and making Europe evolve, usually in a more federalist direction.
The second crisis was migrant surge, 2015. And as I recall, it involved Turkey. This is migrants coming out of the Middle East, but there were also migrants coming out of North Africa. And the solution really isn't evident to me. There are some countries still complaining. There's Turkey still threatening to release more. There are barriers put up between Greece and Turkey. And then there is the unanswered matter of this, of the countries that did accept migrants, and now there's disorder because of that. So is the European Union now in a place where it can accept the new immigrant surge out of Ukraine?
Yeah. So the migrant crisis, I think, arguably was the worst crisis in terms of it. It showed the EU kind of at its worst. And again, it was born out of a just a flawed architecture that in theory, the EU or large parts of the EU are a single zone. You can travel across the EU without a passport or an ID card in what's called the Schengen zone, which takes in most of the EU. But every country remains responsible for policing their own borders. And some countries, for example, say Poland as an example, felt strongly that if a migrant arrived into Italy and wanted to travel to the rest of the Union, then it should be up to Italy to police its borders. And those migrants should be processed and housed and so on by Italy. Italy felt very strongly that it wasn't its fault and that there should be a shared burden across the EU. This became just a horrible and unpleasant and frankly, sometimes quite xenophobic mess, which was never really resolved. It was only resolved insofar as it was resolved is because Germany said, you know, we will take in the migrants that other countries don't want. That had later repercussions in Germany, also in bits of Scandinavia that took in lots of migrants. There was a bit of a populist backlash. And we saw at the time, maybe I was going to say ironically, maybe that's not the right word, but at the time, Eastern European countries like Poland, like Hungary, notably said, you know, we don't want any of these migrants coming into Europe. And that presaged something that we couldn't see come 7-8 years later, that is today, in which they have taken in a huge number of migrants from Ukraine and have done so relatively happily. So although the migration crisis was never resolved, circumstances have evolved as such that it's less toxic now than it was 7 years ago.
The third crisis, Brexit, unsolved. My reporting out of London is that it now turns on a ferocious debate in the parliament over a hard border or soft border at Northern Ireland. And there you indicate in your column, Charlemagne, that there are bad feelings. Bad feelings in Brussels? I know there are in London, as Brussels resents still this presentation by the Boris Johnson and the Tories.
Yeah. Well, firstly, this is an internal European mess, right? This mess is entirely self-made, and the Brexit was self-inflicted. At least the Eurozone crisis came from somewhere else, but Brexit is one of those things that Europe and Britain managed to create out of thin air. The relationship post-Brexit was always going to be difficult. In one sense, Brexit was a success for the EU because one of the aims in Brussels and in Paris and in Berlin and so on was to ensure that nobody else would ever think it was a good idea to leave the EU. And from that point of view, they have absolutely succeeded. Nobody has thought about leaving the EU since Britain because they've seen how complicated it is and how acrimonious it is. The flip side of that coin is that the relationship with Britain is bad. It remains tense. And you have to remember, Britain is one of two kind of capable armies in Europe, the other one being France. And so there's a lot of stuff. There are a lot of issues, for example, Ukraine, where Britain and France and the rest of the EU need to work hand in hand. And that relationship is not what it should be. So it's a manageable crisis, but it's an irritant and it's going to continue being an irritant for years to come.
And then arrives the pandemic, COVID-19. Reading from this side of the water, reading it, it was very well handled in information and transportation. There were bumps when it came to some of the vaccines early on. However, then there were considerations of money being transferred into states that were especially hard. I'm thinking of Italy. So is it now regarded as a success the way it was managed?
It is regarded as a success in Brussels. There are a couple of things that they did well. The first is they prevented the edifice from collapsing. So the EU is a kind of an open space kind of it's a project really about opening up European countries to each other. And when you have a pandemic, the immediate reflex is for borders to come back up because you don't want disease to spread. You want masks that are made in Italy to stay in Italy. You want paracetamol that's made in France to stay in France. And the EU did actually a relatively good job in making sure that the EU didn't kind of break up in that way. The second good job that it did is this next generation EU fund. So in the way that you didn't have solidarity during the Eurozone crisis, you did have solidarity. You had this big $750 billion pot of money, which was jointly borrowed by all the countries in the EU and given some of it, given some of it loaned to the countries that were hardest hit or to poorest countries. That was the kind of transfers, financial transfers that you need to see, and particularly in a crisis. That was well handled. The real sour note was around vaccines. Europe decided to procure vaccines jointly for everybody in the EU. It was felt that that was the only way of doing it, or else countries would be fighting each other for vaccines. The problem is that they didn't do a very good job of it, certainly compared to the UK, certainly compared to the US. And as a result, there were several weeks, several months even, about a year ago now, where Europe was the only rich place in the world that both had lots of cases, but also very few vaccines. So that meant more lockdowns, it meant more deaths, it meant more long COVIDs. And that's a real blot on the EU copybook.
And the present Ukraine war, the determination here requires an understanding I don't have. There's the EU and there's NATO. They can look similar. Are they behaving in a uniform fashion now, handling the money, the weapons, and the alarm bells along the frontier?
Yeah. So NATO does military stuff and EU does essentially all of the rest. The other big difference, obviously, is that NATO is underpinned by America, which is by far the world's biggest military. And most countries in Eastern Europe feel like it's NATO and specifically America that guarantees their independence. That basically it's the thing that ensures that Putin doesn't march into Poland or into Lithuania. So that's always been a point of contention in Europe between the French, for example, who feel like Europe should be in charge of its own security, and Eastern Europe that thinks actually, you know, we don't know that the French army would be kind of big enough to repel an invasion from Russia. All those roles are evolving now. Europe wants to be more involved in defense. Germany has just announced a big splurge in defense. European countries want to spend more money. Specifically, I think procuring stuff together. So making sure that if Italy buys a tank and Slovenia buys missiles, that the two will somehow be able to work together. That's a really long shot. That's a really long process. It'll take many, many years until Europe is, the EU is sort of a credible near military alliance. For now, when we talk about security in Europe, we still talk about NATO. It is kind of the only game in town. And one of the things that we've seen in the past few weeks, in fact, the past few days, is two members of the EU, Sweden and Finland, who weren't previously members of NATO, applying to join the alliance. So in a sense, it's going to gain even more importance in guaranteeing the security of Europeans going forward.
I want to speak to Sweden and Finland application, because this also involves the other part of the conflict, which is energy. I'm speaking to Stanley Pignal, the columnist Charlemagne for The Economist magazine, about the EU and its successes through crisis, well, a hit or miss. But right now, the energy story is not played out. We have a worldwide shortage in fuel. We have a worldwide shortage in food. I'm John Batchelor.